Yeah, they're there. Exactly. But since we know that these records exist, Vale said, we know to request them. And that's what I just did. I asked for all PD-42 initial reports and PD-42s, the supplementals. Basically, all ROIs, he said, using cop speak for reports of investigation. That explains why we didn't know about this case when we were looking into marks for the Bloodlines killings. Kind of an important thing not to be aware of. Shit happens in police work, especially where records and technology are involved. You know that. Had a thing like this in New York, so yeah, I know. They arrived at police headquarters, formerly known as the Public Safety Center or the Massey Building, an aging 1960s-era structure with leaking pipes, malfunctioning air conditioning, and its most endearing feature, asbestos. They got out of the car and started trudging forward in the fresh layer of snow. The new HQ will be finished later this year, Curtis said, gesturing to a partially constructed 8-story edifice. We move in next year. Kinda miss that old building. Really? Nope. They walked past the 12-level public safety facility to the Massey Annex, the archive center commonly referred to simply as the Records Room by Fairfax County Police. They passed a sign that divided visitors into two categories, citizens and police. They headed right, down a short alcove, to a 20-year-old woman with her hair pulled back in a bun. Curtis badged the clerk and explained what he needed. Already spoke with the sergeant about it. He just called. Give me some time to find it. As she walked off, Vale looked at Curtis. She's kind of young, no? Cadets, prospective police officers. Gotta be creative with county budgets. Put the eager, low-cost bodies where you need 'em, where they can't do any damage. The woman returned an hour later with a thin folder. Copies of the marks file. It's a really, really old case. Not to worry, Vale said. Marks is updating his body of work as we speak. Curtis elbowed Vale away and gave the clerk a disarming smile. Thanks. Appreciate your help. They went back to the warmth of Vale's car. She clapped her gloved hands together and looked over at Curtis as he pulled open the folder. He gave it a quick once-over while Vale turned up the heater and defroster. So, it looks like Stuckey was being straight with us, assuming this Lance guy told the truth, and it's a stretch to make that assumption. It went down like Stuckey said. When they arrested Marks, he was charged with improper discharge of a firearm and involuntary manslaughter. But once they found and interviewed Lance, his finger tracked down the page. Kubiak. Lance Kubiak. When they sat down with him, they accepted his version of events and null-prossed it. Vale knew that was a bastardized version of a Latin term nolle prosequi, meaning they decided not to prosecute the case against Marks. Curtis harumphed. Forensics didn't exactly match up. Gunshot residue was inconclusive. There was residue on Marks and a trace amount on Eddie Simmons, the deceased teen. But with Marks in the wind for, Curtis turned a couple of pages and consulted the paperwork, 3 hours, that kind of ruined the evidentiary value. They expected to find more on Simmons' hands if they were struggling for the gun, but it wasn't enough to press forward with a case, especially with their only witness corroborating Marks' version of events, tainted as that accounting was. So where does this leave us? Curtis closed the file. Not sure. Looks like Lance Kubiak knows what really happened, assuming he's still alive. He's someone that Marks put his trust in once before. Could be he does it again. Curtis cocked his head. What? I can't see Marks making that mistake, tracking down old friends. He's wise to that. He's too smart, too careful to let us trap him like that. Is he? He contacted Stuckey. And what did that get us? Something on a 30-year-old case? Nothing on where Marks is in the present day. We'll see about that. For now, we follow the marshal's recipe, and a key ingredient of that recipe is watching known associates, family, and friends, Let's find Lance Kubiak and see if he's had contact with Marks. It's another bread trail. Curtis checked his watch. Speaking of bread, I'm starving. We totally blew past lunch. I'll drop you off at your car. I'm running late for a meeting at the academy. Vail strode into the administration building and signed in at the front desk, then texted Art Rooney to tell him she had arrived. He suggested that she meet him at the gymnasium. She passed through the magnetron scanner, then headed straight past the auditorium, library, and classrooms, and onto the physical education wing. As she made her way down the hall, she saw Rooney opening the door to the pool area. Art! Rooney turned, nodded at her. Trying to squeeze in a short workout before heading off to an appointment. You mind? That's fine. I got hung up over at Fairfax County PD. Took the clerk an hour to pull a file from the archives. Normally, I wouldn't care, but I've got a dinner appointment. Speaking of dinner, Robbie and I had a guy over last night, former ATF agent who did time in the fire lab. He tossed a pair of swim goggles onto a railing and continued on to the stairs, which led down to the main level of the cavernous gym. Anyone I know? Richard Prati, now with DEA Special Operations? Rooney pursed his lips. Doesn't ring a bell. We had a chance to chat about crime concealment fires. Anything new on that case? Got back some forensics on the latest scene, he said, grabbing a basketball off a wheeled cart. Come shoot some hoops with me before I swim laps. Vail removed her shoulder holster and placed it around the head of an oversized gray and black cuff man dummy, which was outfitted with Velcro and designed to teach the proper techniques for applying handcuffs. Anything surprising? Rooney took a shot and the ball swished but came off to the right toward Vail. She snatched it up and threw a bounce pass to Rooney, who caught the ball, dribbled left, then pulled up for a jumper. It hit the side of the rim, and Vail again gathered it up, fed Rooney as he moved toward the basket and laid it in. Hey, you're good at this. I've played with Robbie and Jonathan. They taught me well. Can't shoot worth shit, but I'm good at rebounding and passing. So, the forensics? He pulled up and took another shot. I'll have to show you everything when you've got some time. Getting close to identifying the accelerant. I thought it was Sterno gel. That's the one we found, but I knew he had to have used a more conventional and effective accelerant. And? And I should have an answer soon. Keep me posted. Sounds like this is shaping up to be an interesting case. Definitely challenging. He dribbled once and took another shot. But that's not what you came here to discuss, is it? You had a case a couple of years ago, that homosexual serial, Pedrova? Yeah, what about him? I wanted to pick your brain. I think Roscoe Lee Marks might be gay. Something Thomas Underwood missed or overlooked or discounted. Nothing in his case file about it. Have you spoken to Tom about it? Left a message. Hasn't returned my call yet. He could be traveling. Let's say you're right. The purpose of our assessment is to help identify the kind of person doing the deed, but we know who it is. He's not an unsub, so is this just curiosity on your part, or is there some relevance that I'm missing? If he is gay, then it could impact how the Fugitive Task Force goes about looking for him. Rooney nodded. Okay, so then let's talk homosexual serial killers. A lot of the well-known serials were gay, but there isn't necessarily a predominance of gay serials relative to the general population, so it won't be unusual if he's homosexual. Right. Again, it's only significant in terms of finding him. If I remember right, Rooney said, Marks excised the male genitalia, right? Correct. I'm thinking that could be his way of making the male body look more feminine. Cut away the penis and testicles, you've got a more female body type. Rooney took a shot, and it clanged off the rim, hit the backboard, and fell through the net. And why would he do that? Vail gathered up the ball and bounced it while she thought. He's uncomfortable with his homosexuality, and he's trying to make the men, who he's attracted to, look more like women, who he feels he should be attracted to. He held out his hands and she threw him a chest pass. Could be. I'll accept that, but didn't he kill women also? Yeah, it was one of the things I was going to ask him about before he escaped. Two different killers? They found forensics at two crime scenes, one male victim and one female victim, that fingered marks. Okay, Rooney took a shot. Well, there are some killers who don't have a preference for a particular type of victim, but most do. The rebound caromed to Vale. Right. So? So, for those who do, it's unusual for them to have more than one victim preference, but they can stray from that preference when their type isn't available. So if he likes white females, and the night he has the urge he can't find a white woman, he kills a Hispanic, then he'll go back to whites. He gestured at her. Go on, take a shot. She dribbled and then launched a 15-foot jumper. The ball swished the net. I thought you said you can't shoot worth shit. I purposefully set low expectations. See how impressed you were? You mean you lied, Rooney laughed as he gathered up the ball and started walking toward the rack. So you think that's what happened with Marks? His type wasn't available, so he went after a woman those times? Not sure, but I think there's more to it. Someday soon, I hope to ask him about it. Her Samsung vibrated. It was a text from Hurdle. Another Mark's body. Need you and Curtis here ASAP. Where are you? She replied and asked for the address. Problem? Vale realized she had suddenly gone quiet, focused on her phone. Another Mark's, Vic. Gotta go. Rooney set the ball on the rack. You want to talk some more tomorrow? I think I'm good for now. Let you know. She jogged out of the gymnasium, trying to reach Curtis as she ran. He answered as she hit the door. 10 minutes later, she was driving through the security booth at Quantico, headed for a wooded area near Cub Run. Chapter 21. Sleepy Hollow Road, Falls Church, Virginia. Mark stood in the shade of a large black walnut tree, its trunk a good 3 feet in diameter and offering solid cover from oncoming cars. The snow had not packed down around the tree, but it was only a few inches deep. Its dense canopy of branches had shielded the ground from any significant accumulation. He was getting chilled again, which meant he could not remain here much longer. But his goal was not simply to find shelter for the evening. He needed cash and some decent food. A bed and a hot shower would be a good bonus. Marks had ditched the Jensen sedan earlier in the day because there would be a stolen vehicle alert circulating among police officers. And with law enforcement patrols likely beefed up because of his escape, the risks of having the car now outweighed its benefits. He had selected a wealthy neighborhood and was waiting for a luxury automobile. Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Porsche, he wasn't picky. When one came along and turned into a nearby driveway, that would be his first mark. He would observe for a while, scout out who was in the house, and determine if it was a feasible target. Since there was only one of him, he had to maximize his odds of a successful intrusion. No dogs was his first screening criterion. His second was a fair amount of foliage around the front door, where he would likely enter, to block the view of anyone from the street. Third was no males, or it had to be one smaller than him. Good odds of that. It was late afternoon, so he figured that most men had not left work yet. Yeah, that was a bit of an assumption. More women were breadwinners in families nowadays, especially in cities and sleeper towns for corporate centers. But playing the averages, he figured most of the people in this affluent area had a high-earning male in the household, and chances were the woman was at home raising the kids. Or a nanny was, in which case he could make her summon the wife home. As the minutes ticked by, he realized that the longer he stood there, despite the tree's cover, his odds of being reported to police as a suspicious person increased. A neighborhood like this, where property values were exceptionally high and the power halls of Washington exceptionally close, cops responded in short order. You never knew who would get pissed at a slow roll-up of a patrol car. a CEO, a lobbyist, a congressional representative, a State Department executive. Safer for dispatch to jump on it when a call came in, and for the officers to hightail it over. He bent his knees, attempting to get the blood flowing and restore sensation to his toes. As he flexed his fingers, a car moved down Sleepy Hollow, its xenon headlights a telltale sign that the vehicle was expensive. The turn signal flicked on. Marks moved against the rough bark and watched as the vehicle slowed and then hung a right into the long driveway that led up to the single-story brick house set back from the street and behind a rolling berm of snow-covered grass. It was a Mercedes. Very good. He shifted left, keeping his hands on the tree trunk, and peered into the gray distance. The garage door rolled up and the sedan pulled to a stop. There was space for two vehicles, meaning, hopefully, the other one was for the husband, and he was not home yet. Marks moved out from behind his cover and walked toward the house, using the trees and hedges to shield himself from the neighboring home to his right. He stopped and watched as a woman in her late 30s or early 40s got out. It looked like a child followed her from the rear driver's side door. Like a tiger, salivating over his prey, he licked his cold, dry lips. This was exactly what the criminal ordered. Chapter 22. Vale arrived at the crime scene almost 45 minutes later. She knew Hurdle's car by now and slid in between it and Curtis's sedan. Vale figured that Johnson must be there too. "Talk to me," she said as she approached Hurdle. "Deceased is a resident of that house," he said with a nod of his chin west of their location. The gray, snowy sky was darkening, evening approaching rapidly. "And that?" "That," Curtis said, "is a barn. It's also our crime scene." Vale lifted her brow. "Really? Let's go check it out." "Already seen it," Hurdle said. "Want me to tell you what I think?"
"Actually, no. You're not a homicide investigator.
Neither are you."
"I was," Vale said. "Been there, done that, so, yeah, I know my way around a crime scene."
She snapped on gloves and struggled to pull booties over her wet shoes. Hurdle squared his shoulders. "So do I."
"Let me back up," she said, straightening and stamping her foot to reseat her boot. "I want to walk into that barn and see it for myself, without your biases."
"My biases?" Vale scratched a phantom itch along her right temple.
"I don't want you to interpret things for me. Nothing against you or your investigative skills."
Hurdle held up his hands. "Fine, I'll keep my mouth shut." As Vale and Curtis approached the barn, Leslie Johnson emerged, pulling off her rubber gloves as she exited. "Hey," Vale said. Johnson gave her a nod.
"You might be disappointed."
"Is there a dead body in there?"
"Matter of fact, nope."
"No."
"Like I said, you might be disappointed."
"Do we have a body?"
"We do," Hurdle said. "Neighbor's dog dug it up. That's why Fairfax County PD got called."
Johnson handed Vale a flashlight and Vale entered, Curtis right behind her. A couple of bare bulbs hanging from the canted ceiling gave off inadequate illumination, but Vale could make out a puddle of what looked like dried blood pooled on the cement, a few feet from a workbench where dozens of tools were mounted on a pegboard. Vale shone her beam from left to right, sweeping the area. She stopped and focused on a spot ahead of her, then stepped closer.
What the hell?"
Curtis came up beside her.
"What?"
"Blood smear. See?" Vale directed the light to the middle of a cross-cut handsaw, its metal surface pocked with rust and the remnants of dried maroon bodily fluid. She shifted her light a bit farther along the workbench and stopped on a long, round tool.
"That's one nasty gizmo. What the heck is it?"
It had sharp, saw-like teeth, but it was shaped like a screwdriver. Curtis tilted his head, sizing it up. "Looks like something you'd stick into a hole to make it larger, like a reaming tool, but with a lot more teeth." Not sure what it is, but it makes for one wicked weapon.
She examined it and then turned to Hurdle. Let's get the crime scene tech back in here. Make sure she got some good photos of these bloody tools.
He nodded and whistled.
Time of death?
Sometime this morning. Vale turned and looked at the bloodstain on the ground.
So I'm thinking he stabbed the victim with that long, whatever the hell it is, and killed him here. Then he moved the body?
Who lived here? Curtis asked. Do we know who the vic is?
William Reynolds, 73, Johnson said, re-entering the barn. Wife died last year, lived alone.
And why were we called? Vale asked. I mean, why did they assume Marks is the offender?
Simple, Hurdle said. We're notified of any violent crime in the region. With an escaped fugitive on the loose, let alone a murderer, the first assumption is it's related to our case.
Makes sense.
There was also a report of someone matching his description here last night. Vale drew her chin back.
Wasn't it checked out?
Cruiser came by, Hurdle chuckled, but the officer didn't look in the barn.
You're shitting me!
What can I say? He knocked on the door of the house, looked around, didn't see anything out of the ordinary, walked to the grounds, then left. They screwed up.
You think? Vale sighed.
I've seen it before. It happens. But it's always a head shaker.
Did he take Reynolds' car? Curtis asked.
There's an old 69 Dodge registered to him, and it's still in the driveway.
That's interesting, Hurdle said.
Maybe. Vale gave a glance around the barn interior. I was Marks, I'd think twice about taking Reynolds' car, because it's a unique year and model, and people in these parts know it's his. If they see a strange person driving it, they call Reynolds. Don't get an answer, maybe stop by and see the blood.
Riskier to flag down a hitchhiker, Johnson said.
Probably true. Vale gave a final look around, her gaze settling on the pooled blood. So he stabbed Reynolds right here. She glanced back at the saw, then let her gaze drift a few feet to the left where a shovel leaned against the back wall.
Oh, shit. Don't tell me.
Where's the body?
Well, Hurdle said. I used the term body loosely, because...
He cut it up, didn't he? Vale pulled her eyes away from the rusty tool.
Hurdle shoved both hands in his pockets.
He did.
Didn't want it found, Curtis said. Ever.
So much for the best laid plans of men, Vale shook her head.
You want to see the body parts? Hurdle asked. You know, so you can... Form your own opinions without bias?
Smartass. Let's go take a look.
Hurdle lifted his brow. Detective, what about you?
I'm good, Curtis said. I got this, Johnson gestured with her chin.
Follow me.
Johnson led the way out back, trudging through the snow, which was still falling, though it had slowed to a flurry.
You sure you want to see this? Or has the marshal gotten under your skin?
She glanced at Vale and flashed a wide smile.
Vale shared the laugh.
You know me too well, Leslie. Posturing aside, though, still a good idea to take a look.
They walked up to a temporary tent where the three crime scene technicians were kneeling over a shallow grave, bright Klieg lights flooding the area.
Vale stepped up and introduced herself. Find anything unusual?
The lead crime scene detective was working with a grid, taking a photo of what looked like a hand.
You mean other than a hacked-up body buried behind a barn?
Okay, I deserved that.
Yeah, other than that.
He knew what he was doing. Cut through the joints, shoulder, knee, hip.
But why? I mean, what if someone sees him hacking away at the body?
We have to take a better look around tomorrow, Johnson said, when we've got some daylight. He probably cut the body up somewhere safe where no one would see, maybe inside the barn.
Fair enough. He probably enjoyed doing it, too. He's been under extreme stress since the escape. Could have been a pressure release valve for him. Upon returning to the barn, Ray Ramos was there with Travis Walters and Jim Morrison. Hurdle peered around Morrison when the door opened and found Vale. "I told them all to get their tails over here rather than sitting in the command center by themselves. We'll go through some things, then break for the night." "I gave them all a quick and dirty rundown of what we're dealing with here," Curtis said. "You get some good impressions?" Hurdle asked.
"I did," Vale said. "Body parts were severed at the joints, which was unnecessary. He could have buried a whole body just as well as one in pieces."
"Easier to dig a smaller hole," Ramos said.
"Correct me if I'm wrong," Vale said. "I'm no carpenter, but I'm pretty sure it takes a lot longer to use a wood saw to cut up a body than it does to dig a larger grave."
"Affirmative," Walters said. "I dabble in my spare time. With woodworking."
"I didn't think you dabbled with severed body parts."
"But not only did he have to dig a hole," Ramos said, "he had to dig a hole in frozen ground after he cleared the snow away. A smaller hole makes sense."
"All true," Walters said, "but it's still easier than sawing through multiple joints."
"Either way," Vale said, "he was taking a big chance. He had to stick around a substantial amount of time to dig the hole or sever the limbs, which is extremely messy and a lot of effort. Even if he did the cutting in a place where he wouldn't be seen, it's still taking a huge, unnecessary risk. It'd fit a smaller grave, yeah, but cutting it up doesn't make it harder to find."
"Meaning what?" Morrison asked.
"Meaning that this could be significant. If this was a new case where I didn't know the killer, I'd say this is part of his ritual, but we know who this offender is. I'm not talking about identity, but his psychological basis for the behavior he engages in."
"And?" Hurdle said.
"And I can't say this makes a lot of sense. It would if it fit the ritual we've seen in his past murders, but it doesn't."
"So how do you explain it?"
Vale thought about that a moment. "This wasn't a typical victim. If I had to guess on the sequence of events, he was cold and hungry and tired. He came upon the house, saw the barn, and figured he'd take the path of least resistance. Spend the night there, keep out of sight, then in the morning stake out the house, wait for the owner to leave, then break in and get some food, maybe take a shower and get a change of clothes, cash if there was any in the house. If he was lucky, a firearm." But William Reynolds needed something in the barn and found Mark sleeping.
"How do you know he was sleeping?" Walters asked.
"I don't, but if he wasn't sleeping, he probably wouldn't have still been in the barn. And based on the blood here, our Vic was killed in the barn, not in the house."
"Your point?" Ramos asked.
"Just that this wasn't a planned kill. Probably the opposite. It was one of necessity. Once Reynolds stumbled onto Marks, he was a goner. Marks couldn't take a chance on Reynolds blabbering about his whereabouts."
"I thought this guy was smart," Morrison said.
"He is, but even smart criminals make mistakes, just like smart cops make mistakes, and he's been on the run in the dead of winter in a snowstorm. He's tired and hungry, and he might not be thinking clearly, so he saw the tools and went to town on the body."
"He does have a history of cutting," Curtis said. "He just took it further this time."
"Okay," Hurdle said. "So we know Marks was here last night and this morning. Anyone else have new information?"
"We do," Curtis said. "Karen and I tracked down one of his buddies, Vincent Stuckey. He's been in contact with Marks, but nothing that's going to help us. Stuckey's a little slow, so we don't have a problem with the veracity of the information he gave us."
"Slow," Morrison said.
As in his bulb ain't too bright?"
"He suffered a GSW to the head when he was a teenager," Vale said, "and that brings us to an incident with Marks back when they were 14. Turns out, Marks' first murder was potentially involuntary manslaughter, if you believe the lone witness, which was his friend, another guy we've got to look into.
Lance Kubiak.
Kubiak? Ramos said. You sure of that?
Vale glanced at Curtis, who nodded.
Yeah, Lance Kubiak. He was a childhood friend of Mark's. Kubiak, Marx, and Stucky were supposedly hanging out, getting high, when this loner comes up to them, a kid they knew, name was Eddie. He brought a gun to the gathering, and Marx and Eddie got into it. The gun went off, killed Eddie, and wounded Stucky. No charges were brought. Ramos had his pocket spiral notebook out and was flipping the pages. Kubiak. Lance Kubiak.
Like I said, yeah. Why?
Because Lance Kubiak also happens to be the name of a correctional officer at Potter.
Chapter 23. Marx stood in the backyard, which was well shielded from surrounding homes by dense trees and hedges. Even in winter, they provided more than adequate concealment. He inched over to the back door and looked through the large picture window. Leather sofas, stone flooring of some kind, indirect lighting that shone up toward the ceiling rather than down toward the floor. A redhead, 30s, attractive, with a substantial diamond ring and matching tennis bracelet, flitted by. She was rushing about the kitchen putting together a snack of some sort as the child, maybe 4 or 5, sat in front of a flat panel television that filled the wall opposite the couch. They had plasma TVs before he went away to prison, but nothing this big, this bright. He would not mind spending a few nights in this place. He would have to see how things transpired in the next hour or so to determine if that was feasible. Marx tried the doorknob to no avail. He had learned a long time ago to always check, because you never knew. People were funny that way, thinking that for some reason it was safe to leave their houses unlocked, while others just could not be bothered or did not give it a second thought. No matter. It just made the intrusion a little bit tougher. One of his former cellmates, Orlando, schooled him in the best way to approach such a situation. He could have pulled it off without Orlando's tips, but why not learn from someone who had experience? Of course, he asked Orlando, not so tactfully, if the reason for his ending up in the slammer was from a failed home invasion. It was not. So he felt confident that the counsel Orlando was meeting out was solid. Marx checked the door one last time, evaluating it like his former roommate had described. Then he kicked it in, using just the right amount of pressure to pop the lock. Do it wrong and you could injure your knee and ankle, and he wanted no part of that. The noise from the TV partially masked the bang. He was careful not to let the door swing open so hard that it struck something on the rebound and shattered the glass. That was sure to attract attention. The woman turned, locked eyes with Marx, and froze. Her body recoiled in fear, shoulders drawing forward, hands coming out in front of her as if that would stop him. She opened her mouth to scream, but Marx was prepared, and faster. He leaped forward and clamped his large hand down on her fine-boned face. "No need to make noise," he said calmly into her ear. "I'm not going to hurt you or your daughter if you cooperate and do what I tell you to do. The opposite's true, too. Do anything that puts me in a bad way and I'll kill you both. And worry about the consequences later. It's survival instinct. Understand?" He leaned back, appraised her face. She was terrified, eyes glazed and straining left, trying to see her little girl. "Nod if you understand everything I just told you. No noise, no problems for me. You and your daughter live. Got it?" She nodded vigorously, indicating that she had a grasp of the situation. "I'm going to let go of your mouth. Tell me your name, calmly and quietly." He glanced over at the girl. She was still engrossed in her cartoon. It was an animated show featuring animals. Now, there's a unique concept. "Here we go,"
he said as he released the pressure on her face. Victoria, she whispered.
Good. Victoria. Orlando had told him to use their names as much as possible. And your girls?
Cassie.
Very nice. I like Cassie. Now, in a minute, you're going to introduce me to her as a guest and tell her that she should make me feel welcome. Got it?
Victoria nodded.
When's your husband due home?
Victoria's gaze went wild, up, down, left, right. Orlando had told him to always read the eyes, because they held the key to what the person was thinking.
No, 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 Victoria. A lie will only piss me off.
He clenched his jaw.
And I'm getting kind of angry even entertaining the thought that you'd think of lying to me.
He left his fury exposed, using it to show her that he could turn on her at any second. It was just like training a dog. Do as I say, and I'll give you a treat. But do something bad, pee in the house, and you'll be very, very sorry. He pointed his finger at her, put it right in her face, inches away from her eyes.
Tell me truthfully, when's your husband due home?
What time is it? She blurted it, and Cassie turned, perhaps thinking that her mother was asking her the question.
Now, Victoria, he said under his breath, I'm a guest. Tell her.
Victoria tried to make her face smile.
Cassie, honey, we have a guest. He's come by for dinner. Let's make him feel at home, okay?
Cassie slid off the couch and walked into the kitchen. She leaned against her mother's right leg and wrapped her arm around her thigh, sizing up marks.
What's your name?
It's Lee. Nice to meet you.
Her gaze drifted around his body and face. He had not showered, and his clothing did not fit well, so he probably looked a bit ragged. He did as Orlando suggested, forge ahead, not allow them any time to think.
So, how old are you, Cassie?
He let his voice rise and fall like he did with Jasmine when she was young. Regardless of what she said about him, he treated her well. She held up five fingers.
Five's a good age.
He wanted to get rid of her, to send her back to the television without doing it too obviously.
What's that show you're watching? I'm not familiar with it.
Wild Kratts.
She was not saying much, which went along with her body language. Fear, perhaps shyness around strangers, but he also had to be prepared to handle an unpredictable outburst, the wild card in a situation like this. He knew what Victoria was thinking. Could he kill a child?
I think Cassie should go back and enjoy the rest of her program, don't you, Mom?
Yes, honey. Go back to the couch and watch your show.
She pushed her gently away from her leg and, using both hands on her daughter's back, guided her toward the family room. As Cassie walked away, glancing over her shoulder at Mark's, he grinned at her and then said to Victoria between his teeth,
"When's your husband coming home?"
4:30. Any minute.
Mark's felt his shoulder muscles tighten. His mind went blank. He squinted, trying to recover, hide his sudden weakness.
Is there a gun in the house?
We don't believe in guns.
He turned and surveyed the kitchen. A Henkel knife block sat on the dark gray, black, and white granite counter beneath the window. He stepped over and pulled out a couple, chose a serrated blade of medium length. Very good, recently sharpened.
What are you going to do with it?
I'm not going to kill you with it, if that's what you're worried about, or anyone else, if you cooperate.
Then why do you need it?
Victoria, really? It's in case you don't cooperate.
And for control. But he did not tell her that. He slipped it into his back jeans pocket. A low rumble vibrated by the far wall.
Daddy's home,
Cassie said as she slid off the couch. Marks rushed across the room and took Cassie by the hand.
Shh, hang on there, darling. Let's surprise him.
He put his large hand across her belly and lifted her up in one motion toward his body.
I've got a present for him, and I don't want to ruin the surprise, okay?
What's the surprise?
Oh, it's a really good one. Wait till you see his face.
Without taking his eyes off the family room door that led to the garage, he said,
Victoria, what's his name?
Victoria put a hand over her mouth and mumbled,
Nathan.
It came out as a muffled whimper, but Marks understood what she said. Marks moved into the blind side of the door as it opened, and Nathan walked in. Physically fit, but no threat to Marks, who had about 4 inches and 50 to 75 pounds of muscle on him. Nathan saw his wife's terrified face and stepped farther into the house as he swung his head left toward Marks, but it was clear his brain did not register the man's presence. His gaze was riveted to Cassie.
Who are you? Nathan said, recovering.
Marks kicked the door shut. He was not going to give Nathan a chance to escape back into the garage. Then again, he was reasonably certain that a husband and father would not leave his wife and daughter with an intruder.
Just do what I say, and no one gets hurt.
Who the hell do you think you are? Nathan repeated, anger and dominance permeating his tone. And this was another moment where Orlando's guidance would prove useful. Nathan was likely a man of importance, perhaps a vice president or even a CEO, someone accustomed to being in charge, calling the shots, directing people around. Marks reached into his pocket and drew the knife out. He held it up. He did not slap it against the girl's neck. He did not raise his voice. Cassie began crying. She squirmed, but Marks held her against his body with a vice-like grip. He brought his right hand, which held the hankle blade, against her mouth.
I'm the man holding your wife and daughter at knife point. I'm the man you're going to listen to. The man you're going to be courteous to. Got it? Nathan?
Nathan's eyes widened. His breathing became shallower, his bravado replaced by fear for his family's well-being.
Just put my daughter down. Let my wife leave with my daughter.
Victoria and Cassie aren't going anywhere, Mark said. He knew that using their names, thereby showing familiarity with Nathan's family, would be unnerving. Questions would be darting through his thoughts. What else did he know about them? Had he been stalking them? What was this about?
What jewelry and cash do you have in your house?
Do not lie to me, Mark said. Victoria and I have already been through this. Tell him, Vicky.
Tell him the truth, she stammered, and he won't hurt any of us.
Marks turned back to Nathan and tilted his head.
And your answer is?
We've got some diamond rings here, nothing big, and about 200 in cash.
That's it?
Marks shouted, scaring Cassie again.
Quiet, he said, squeezing the girl tighter.
How much do you usually withdraw when you go to the bank?
I don't know. It varies.
What's the most?
Nathan looked to Victoria. Clearly, she was the one who took care of the banking chores.
5,000, she said.
Marks shifted his weight and looked at Cassie. I'm going to release my hand. You are not to cry or scream or yell. If you do, I'll hurt you. Understand? She began whimpering, but did not say anything. Did you hear me? He said firmly.
Yes.
He removed his hand from her mouth and pointed the knife at Nathan. Get over there with your wife. Nathan complied, and Victoria nearly jumped into his arms. Back to Victoria. How often have you withdrawn 5 grand?
I don't know,
she said with a sniffle, her eyes riveted to Cassie.
2x, maybe?
Did it draw attention? Did they ask you about it?
Not on our account, Nathan said. 5,000 isn't a big deal.
I asked Victoria, Nathan. Keep your mouth shut. Marks looked at Victoria and lifted his brow.
Like Nathan said, it's not a problem.
Okay. Still holding Cassie, Marks paced down the hallway, turned and walked back. Victoria, you're going to go in there and withdraw $4,000. She swallowed.
Okay.
And why are you taking the money out? Marks asked.
Why? Nathan asked. Because you're holding us hostage.
Wrong fucking answer, Nathan. See? You say something stupid like that, and cops will come here, and I'll kill you and your daughter. He turned to Victoria. Now, I'll ask again, and I want you to answer. Why are you withdrawing this money?
We're doing some landscape work, and the contractor wanted to be paid in cash because he had to lay out the money for the trees he planted.
Mark shook his head. In the dead of winter with snow on the ground, you planted trees.
We had new carpeting installed.
Marks grinned slyly. Very good, Victoria. Very good. And how far away is the bank?
15 minutes, at most. Probably 12.
Marks nodded slowly. Let's both check the time. He gestured at the digital radio-controlled clock hanging in the kitchen. You can get there and make the withdrawal before they close. Be back here in 40 minutes.
What if I'm late? It's rush hour. I can't control.
I'm a reasonable guy, Victoria. Tell you what, if you're late, I won't kill your daughter or your husband. He held up the knife. But I will chop off 1 finger of Nathan's right hand for every 5 minutes you're past due. Fair enough? Victoria's mouth dropped open and tears welled up in her eyes. I'm talking to you, Victoria. Fair enough? She nodded quickly. Words still too difficult to form in her hysterical state. Good. Give me your cell phone. Victoria dug it out of her purse and handed it over. Now, remember, if I smell anything wrong, if I hear anything out of the ordinary, if I see a car pull up anywhere it's not supposed to, I'm going to stick this knife in your daughter's stomach. Then, he stopped himself. Well,
You don't want to know what I'll do after that. Trust me.
He gave her a reassuring smile.
Now, take a deep breath with me.
Marx threw his shoulders back and filled his lungs. Victoria forced herself to follow suit.
That's it. Good. Okay, now. 40 minutes, starting now.
Victoria ran for the garage door. Chapter 24. A chill rattled Vale's body. This correctional officer, Kubiak, have you interviewed him? Ramos stamped his boots against the barn's cement floor. Scheduled for tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. Mind if I sit in on that?
If you think it'd help, fine with me.
What are the ramifications of this? Curtis asked. Hurdle folded his arms across his chest.
First thought is that this is no coincidence. Second thought is that Kubiak had a hand in the escape, and if he's willing to risk his career to break Marx out of Potter, he may have arranged other things for his friend. Third and most important thought is that he may know something about his whereabouts.
So, you don't think we should wait till tomorrow? Ramos said.
Hell no. Get over there now. I'll call Potter, see if Kubiak's shift is over. If not, I'll make sure he hangs out till you get there, but I'll make it clear they're not to freak him out. We just have some questions. We're looking for help locating the fugitive. That's it. If he's gone for the day, I'll get his home address.
This guy a flight risk? Vale asked.
Only if he realizes that we're on to him. Regardless, I don't want to get blindsided until we know what his deal is. Whether he's helped Marx or not, and I'm thinking he probably did, we treat him as a person of interest and a potential flight risk. Let him prove otherwise.
We've got a wiretap in place for Marx, Ramos said. Since we're already up on that wire, let's see if we can get something for Kubiak.
Vale pulled out her phone to text Robbie that she was not going to make dinner.
Looking for what?
I'm thinking we drop some breadcrumbs, then watch him eat. If he does shit his pants when he hears we want to talk to him, he may call Marx or someone who's in contact with Marx, which may ultimately lead us to Marx.
It's a slower approach, Hurdle said, but I like the idea. And if we weren't dealing with a violent criminal who's just killed 2 people, I'd be on board. But I'm not sure we have time to wait and see if Kubiak may have a way of contacting him.
He turned to Tarkov.
Ben, what do you think?
Tarkov leaned back in his chair.
Try it for a few hours and see if he bites. A guy like that, if he really did put his career on the line to help Marx get out, he's going to want to warn him ASAP. I say if we haven't heard anything in 3 hours, we have another chat with him.
Hurdle rocked back on his heels a few seconds.
Okay, do it.
Does Kubiak have a wife and kids?
Vale asked.
Married, 1 young son, Ramos said, and he rents. Doesn't own his home.
So if he's involved, his career's over anyway, he could take off.
Let's make sure that doesn't happen, Hurdle said.
Yes?
Hell yeah, Ramos said as he gathered his keys off the work table.
Take Vale, get up there and sell it good. Don't give Kubiak any reason to think we know he's Mark's bud.
Chapter 25. Marx sat on the living room couch facing the front window. The curtains were drawn, but he could see through them whenever headlights turned toward the house. While that would give him some warning if police or tactical vehicles came up the driveway, if they set up shop down the street and approached on foot, he was screwed. Of course, this whole escape was fraught with risks. Tonight was just one of many. Nathan sat facing him 3 feet away, not far enough to attempt an escape and not close enough to present a threat. Not that he presented a threat to Marx, but it was better to follow Orlando's rules of engagement, and that meant keeping your distance. Cassie was between them, crying.
At least let me comfort her, Nathan said.
Marx glared at him. Stay right where you are. She'll get over it.
She's just a little kid.
I can see that.
Why are you doing this to us?
Marks debated whether or not to answer him.
Because you had what I needed. I think you could just chalk it up to wrong place, wrong time. In other words, rotten friggin' luck.
Are you going to let us go?
Marks looked away. All depends on Victoria, Nathan. Simple as that.
Victoria had been gone for 38 minutes. Nathan kept checking his luxury watch, no doubt stressing over what was going to happen to them.
I'd like to see that, Mark said, gesturing at the timepiece.
See it or steal it? Nathan asked.
Marks gave him an icy stare. What kind is it?
Tag Heuer, my 15th anniversary present.
Very touching.
He held out his left hand. Nathan unhooked the latch and handed it over, then gave Cassie a brave wink, trying to add a positive spin to the grim situation. If Dad was confident all would be okay, everything had to work out. Marks tried to put the watch on, but it was too tight. He slipped it into his jeans pocket.
Where do you keep your medicine?
Nathan turned away from Cassie.
What?
Your medicine cabinet. For the kid. Where is it?
Her bathroom. Down the hall.
Let's go. Lead the way. Cassie, take my hand. She stopped crying long enough to shake her head, an emphatic no. Marks was not deterred. He gathered her up in his arms, bear-hugging her as they walked down the hallway.
Don't hurt her, Nathan said.
I'm not hurting her, he said as they passed the master bedroom.
Wait.
He pushed Nathan inside, then went to the vanity that Nathan and Victoria used.
Where's your shaver?
Nathan slid a drawer open. Marks removed a Norelco, a comb, and a pair of scissors. He saw a leather dop kit embossed with a George Mason University logo and inserted the grooming items, then took the bag with him back down the hall. They entered Cassie's bathroom, and Marks set her down next to the sink.
Open the cabinet.
Nathan did as instructed, and Marks perused its contents. There were a few over-the-counter bottles, a couple of homeopathic remedies, children's Tylenol, and Benadryl.
Open the Benadryl and fill the little plastic cup.
Nathan struggled with the child protective top.
Calm down, Nathan. Take a breath.
He did just that and steadied his hand long enough to remove the cap. He poured the red liquid, then handed it to Marks.
No, it's for her.
For her? No, she doesn't need...
Don't fucking argue with me, Nathan.
He clenched his fist. It's not a good idea. Or I'll give her the medication and I might not be so gentle. Nathan turned to his daughter and told her to open her mouth. She looked at him, showing some understanding of what was going on, that her daddy was being forced to do things he did not want to do. Still, he was asking her to take medicine, which didn't always taste good, but it was something her parents told her was good for her. She opened her mouth and Nathan poured it in. She made a face but swallowed.
Now you, Mark said.
Same thing. Nathan did as he was told.
Now, take the bottle with us back out to the living room.
As they walked down the hall, Mark said,
Where's your duct tape?
Duct tape?
Everybody's got fucking duct tape, Nathan. I'm not in the mood to play games.
Garage. They retrieved a half-full roll and went into the kitchen, where Marks made Cassie sit in one of the seats. He went about securing her wrists and ankles to the arms and legs, then placed a strip across her lips and around her neck. By now, the Benadryl was having its intended effect, and her crying had become soft, drowsy whimpers. As he sliced the last strip of tape, Marks heard the vibration of the garage door rolling up. In walked Victoria.
Is everything okay?
We're all fine, Marks said. Thanks for asking.
She did not think that was funny. Her eyes found Cassie as she walked into the kitchen.
What's wrong with her? What'd you do to her?
You have something for me?
Victoria handed over an envelope about a half inch thick and went over to Cassie's side.
Leave her alone, Victoria. She's fine, just the way she is.
Marks gave a quick glance inside and saw greenbacks. And now we've got something for you.
Nathan, give your wife a dose.
What?
Victoria turned to Nathan and watched as he filled the cap.
Benadryl?
Just looking out for your well-being. Drink it.
Nathan nodded, and she tipped it back into her mouth.
One more, Nathan.
Two? But
I said one more.
Victoria drank that as well.
Great. Now, Victoria, did you say anything to anyone while you were gone?
Of course not. I did what you asked.
Winter coats?
Victoria looked at Nathan, then indicated the hall closet. Marks took hold of Victoria's arm.
Nathan, go get 3 wool hats.
How do you know we've got 3 wool hats?
Mark stared him down.
Go get the hats.
Nathan's left eye twitched, but he apparently calmed his anger and did not make trouble. He trudged off and retrieved the articles of clothing. Marks took them and slipped one over Cassie's head, covering her eyes. He stepped over to Nathan and held out his left hand.
Car keys. What do you drive?
Mercedes.
That'll do.
Nathan hesitated, then pulled them from his pocket and gave them to Marks, who turned to Victoria.
Seems kind of weird for me to say this, but thank you for following the rules, Vicky. Have a seat at the other end of the kitchen table.
Marks secured her just like he had done with Cassie, except that for her, he stuffed a rag in her mouth before sealing her lips with duct tape. He pulled the second hat over her head and, as with Cassie, brought it down to the level of the bridge of her nose.
When does your cleaning person come?
Nathan recoiled.
How do you...
By now, you've gotta know I'm not some dumb shit criminal.
Somebody with your kind of money doesn't clean his own toilets and mop the floors. Just... answer the question.
Wednesdays, around noon.
Marks absorbed that, thought a moment. The timing would work. He would be far enough away when the maid would discover her subdued boss.
Give me your cell phone.
Nathan fished it out of his jacket pocket, but before Marks took it, he said,
call your office and tell them you've got a stomach flu and you won't be in for a few days. Make it convincing.
When he finished, Marks took the mobile from Nathan and switched it off, dropped it to the tile floor, and smashed it with his heel. He then did the same to Victoria's. He picked up the last wool hat and duct tape and turned to Nathan.
It's just you and me. Let's go.
Go? I thought you were just going to leave us alone. We did everything you asked.
Calm down, Nathan. I don't want to have to make you relax, because I will.
No, I've had enough. You want my car? Fine, take it. You want my watch? Take that too. But just leave.
Nathan never saw it coming. The first punch struck him in the abdomen, and the second fractured his left cheekbone. Victoria and Cassie could not see what was happening, but they could undoubtedly hear. And their imaginations filled in the rest. While their muffled cries expressed their emotions,